Hello and welcome back to Get 2020 Vision. I'm Gemma Milne, and this time we're discussing one of the most talked about issues in any sector right now, women in tech. It's International Women's Day on March 8th, so with that in mind, I wanted this episode to focus on females in technology. Where are the blockers? How easy is it for women to carve out careers in tech? What more can be done to get women into tech? Should we even be talking about women in tech in the first place? For this episode, I've assembled my guests, who share a wealth of experience and knowledge on just this very subject. Joining me today is Dr. Anne-Marie Amafadin, MBE, and Lucy Hamilton, developer at Pace Integration. Welcome to the podcast, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. Really excited to speak with both of you. Before we begin, do you mind introducing yourself to our listeners and telling them a little bit about you and what you do? Lucy, let's start with you.
I'm Lucy, and I'm an integrations analyst developer from Pace Integration. I'm a newly graduate, so I've been working for about a year and a half now in the company. I study maths at uni, so it's been quite a big change. But yeah, that's where I am at the moment.
Lovely. Thank you, Lucy. And Marie.
So I run a social enterprise called Stamets, and I've been doing that for 7 years now. We've just turned seven. I also host a podcast too called Women Tech Charge. So hoping to kind of share maybe some of the stories from that on this. But I also wear lots of different hats. So I'm a trustee at the Institute for Future of Work. I sit on advisory boards and councils at various educational institutions, but also spend a lot of time talking to policymakers and people who can maybe change things around women in tech.
Amazing. So we've got two highly qualified people to be talking about this, both being in tech, talking about tech, trying to make it better for women in tech. But let's do a little bit of place setting before we get into the crux of the discussion. We all know that there's a bit of disparity, or a lot of disparity, when it comes to numbers of women versus men in technology roles. It's a big question, but why do we think there's a shortage of women in these roles? Anne-Marie, I'm going to start with you.
So there's a shortage because of the social norms that we have around technical women. So it's not something that people are aware of. It's not part of our psyches. It's not something that you can kind of point to a woman in tech in the same way that you can maybe point to men in tech or speak about people that have been innovators who are male. So it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of us don't know about the names. We don't know about the Stephanie Shirleys. We don't know about the Gladys Wests. We don't know about people like Katherine Johnson, for example. And so it's ended up then reinforcing stereotypes around the kinds of people that can do tech and the kinds of people that can do well in tech. And so that means, you know, in the education system, lots of people don't choose the things that would maybe be prerequisites for a career in tech. But it also means in the workplace, you know, there's this assumption that they're not the kind of people you want to hire women into technical roles, or the kind of people you want to promote in particular technical teams, or the kind of people that you just want to give positions of responsibility. I think that's all still driven by that social norm of, you know, it's quite a hard thing for you to maybe imagine a technical woman if you've never heard of one, seen one, met one, or needed to respect one.
What do you think, Lucy, from your perspective, being in the role as a woman, you know?
Yeah, no, for me, I definitely agree, especially from coming like out of uni and even back to like when I was at college, thinking about what roles I was going to like go into. Never ever would I have imagined I was going to be a woman in tech, like at all. It was always like maths, numbers, finance, like that was going to be like the route. For me, it's always been like an issue with like the early on actually direction of how are you going to get like women in tech.
It's interesting. I've just realised all three of us studied maths, and all three of us.
Like all the best people.
Yeah. And we all ended up in sort of finance related roles after our degrees and in and around them. But I want to talk about blockers, because obviously we all ended up in these maths roles for whatever reason we did, which to a lot of people would probably seem like, well, you know, you made it. You got into a maths degree. Of course you would have called yourself a woman in STEM or women in tech, because that's what you were doing. And yet, I would agree with you, I wouldn't have thought of myself as a woman in tech until later on. For you guys, what do you kind of perceive as some of the blockers in place for women who are looking to get in or on that route to stumbling, as you said, into these roles?
Well, for me, there wasn't an opportunity realistically through school and college and like even uni to really get involved. So I think that's where the blocker was, like not having any technical like background or guidance in how I was going to be able to apply for a role was a big issue for me.
Even just knowing that these roles sort of exist.
Yeah, knowing that they exist, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
from your experience, I mean, Amber, you speak to so many people in this space and you probably hear about and try and act upon some of these blockers. Give us a little whistle-stop tour of what you see as some of the main issues.
So if we start with the kind of the younger girls or the younger people that I work with, confidence is quite a big blocker. So, you know, wanting to say that you're good at maths, wanting to say that you're good at technology and therefore want to act on that is something that a lot of people struggle with, a lot of young girls struggle with their kind of STEM confidence, as it were. So that's one big blocker, just understanding that it's something you can do. You don't have to be Sheldon Cooper from Big Bang Theory. You can be yourself and want to solve a problem and use technology to do that and be employed to do that. So that's one. I think Lucy touched on another, which is just the awareness of all the options. And I think that's the amazing thing about being in technology is that there are so many different roles, so many different things you can do, whether it's, you know, across Agile, whether it's in development, whether it's in testing, whether it's in project management, the product management, and there's new ones being created every day. You've got big data, we've now got ethics specialists. So understanding that there's so many options for what you can do also becomes a blocker, because then you say, well, I don't want to be a developer. And so then you're like, well, you know, this is the only thing I can do. It's the only thing I know to do. And then another one that we hear quite often is kind of peers, parents, and what we call influencers using their knowledge of stereotypes to reinforce and say, well, you shouldn't do that. So, for example, someone that I know really well is a really top engineer. In fact, she just got an MBE for her contributions to engineering. And you know, she always tells me the story of, you know, her dad was an engineer, her brother was an engineer, and she said to her mum she wants to be an engineer. And her mum said, no, you'll burn everything down. You know, don't do that. And, you know, and that's coming from your own mother or your own teachers or, you know, people that you trust who would just, you know, assume that as a girl or as a woman, it's not something that you should do. So I think those are quite a few of the blockers for just starting off in tech.
I think it's interesting you both touched on this idea of awareness, but then you've also talked about overwhelm, which seems like sort of two sides of the same coin, because I was exactly the same when I was studying maths. I mean, everyone sort of said to me, oh, you can either go into banking or you can be a maths teacher. And I was like, surely there's more I can do with this degree than this. And I was exactly the same once I realized that, you know, all these different options. And I'm just curious as to, do we think that that's still a thing now? I mean, I was at uni in 2009 to 2013. I kind of think of that as, surely the world has moved forward. We have more knowledge of what's going on in tech nowadays. Or is it still that kind of ingrained kind of both from a gender perspective, but also from a lack of understanding of the opportunities that really are in front of us in tech? I mean, you've got a much more recent experience of university than I do, Lucy.
Well, yeah, I'm surprised because where I did obviously do my maths degree and I went to lots of like careers fairs and things like this, but you see the occasional like consulting firm. So there's quite a lot of like consulting firms that you can go and talk to, and going from that angle. In my degree, yes, I did a lot of like little bits of coding, and I guess I could have like, I loved it and I should have like looked further myself, but at the time that wasn't really there. Like, there's the opportunity, but it wasn't.
You can't see. I mean, yeah. If you don't know it's there, how on earth are you going to know to Google it? Exactly. Do you know what I mean? Even though that, yeah, there's an abundance of information. But I guess I'm just curious by this idea of like, you know, you're clearly interested in maths and science from a young age in order to go and do a maths degree. I know I was. I'm sure you were too, Anne-Marie. And yet it still seems like we've all had the same experience, never mind those people who don't even think to go and do what is quite technical education, like a maths degree. And I wonder, you know, is that a gender thing or is that a society thing that we don't talk about tech enough to know that there's opportunities out there?
I think it's a bit of both. So as a society, we don't know. I think if we're being fair to society, technology is moving so quickly and so fast that, you know, lots of people in the technology industry don't know a lot of these things. So I was on a panel yesterday with a teacher who was saying, you know, actually, as a teacher, they're supposed to be preparing these students for the future. And, you know, they've not been in the job market for a while. And so actually they need the resources to know and to say, you know, we're studying X, Y and Z in this particular class. And actually that links to that kind of role or that kind of job. And I think the gender thing is almost like a double whammy on that, because it's, we don't know about these jobs. But even if you did know about them, the person that you're hearing it from or the person that you imagine might do it isn't someone that looks like you, or is, you're never going to look like that kind of person. So I think that's how it ends up being gendered. And say, actually, the last 10 people that I saw or heard of in tech that are making this whiz doodle, whatever it could be, were all called Bob, John and Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, it was a recent study by PwC said that nearly 80% of young women cannot name a female role model working in the tech industry, which, I mean, what do you guys make of that? I can't quite believe that, to be honest, although I can at the same time.
I think I probably fall under that. Like, very sadly, I probably fall under that category myself, yeah. Which, like, surprises me.
Especially because really the only one I probably can think of is someone like a Sheryl Sandberg, who's not necessarily known for being a tech role model, but rather a woman role model, do you know, as opposed to someone who talks about her technical chops but rather lean in and all the sort of rest of it.
I've become a historian, I think I'm gonna call
a hair historian. Oh my goodness.
So I'm not surprised by that stat. In fact, I would tell you it's probably a little bit higher than 80%. Wow. I'm wondering where they fund these girls, but it's one of the things I do all the time. So I speak all the time on stages everywhere to lots of different types of people, and I almost always manage to include like a little game of kind of, you know, spot, you know, who's, what's that, guess who, is it that, yeah, one you have, right? So it's like guess who, and I always have kind of four women up on my slide, and I'm always like, you know, how many of you can recognise four, who can recognise three, who can recognise two? And it's always funny because people kind of maybe put their hands up for two. And typically I'll say, okay, Ada Lovelace is not on this slide. Marie Curie is not on this slide. And you kind of see hands then go back down again. But so I've ended up, and I think for me, if I go to Germany, I want to make sure I have a German woman. If I go to Scotland, you know, I've got the five of these Scottish women in STEM that I can talk about. But I think that's the thing that frustrates me the most. As someone that knows these names and can reel off Gladys Ware, Catherine Johnson, Hedy Lamarr, you know, all these people, it frustrates me that we don't tell these stories, we don't know these stories, and often these people are literally alive the same time. Like Gladys Wist is still alive, she's in Virginia, she's the mathematician that kind of worked out that you could use all the satellites we've got in orbit and figure out where someone is to within a couple of meters on Earth. She's the reason why we have GPS, and we always use GPS, and you know, I'm sure we all used it to get to the studio,
get
today,
here today, yeah.
But we don't think of Gladys when we connect to Wi-Fi, we don't think of Hedy, but these are women that have been behind all these things. So it frustrates me, and it's why I kind of almost on a one woman campaign about lots of different things, but to try and have more movies about these people, like Hidden Figures that we had a couple of years ago, but also try and just insert them into, you know, things like EastEnders and just other shows that you wouldn't normally want to see a female scientist, just to see one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think that gets lost, and that's why people feel such a disconnect maybe from being that woman in tech.
What about the next generation, though? Do we feel that things are getting better or different? Or are young, you know, you work with a lot of girls. Like, do you think that the way they, you know, listen to these messages or hear these messages or think about tech, is it similar to the way we kind of thought about it when we were younger, or do you think it's getting better or different?
So it's funny, we're actually working with QA on a really big program, actually not even a project, of our kind of academies that we're running with them. And what we kind of have seen the frustration and heard the frustration from girls across the country over the last couple of years who want to do computer science at school but can't, or who haven't been chosen for triple science, or all these things that kind of can get in the way if you know tech is what you want to do. And ultimately, it's not really about the grades, even though it might feel like that when you're 14 years old, 15 year old, 16 years old. You know, there are, I think 40% of people working in the tech industry don't have a tech qualification. So what we have done with QA is we're providing free qualifications meant for adults in Agile and Cyber to teenage girls over half terms. So they can apply, it's open application. We don't do an ability test or anything like that beforehand. There is a short interview that I do if you've not been to one of the STEMETS events before. So if they don't have triple science or computer science or A-level or math or whatever it is, they've still got that they can turn up at their first day of work or interviews and say, at 14, I got an Agile Fundamentals qualification, or at 16, I got a cyber qualification. That's how serious I was about this. And it's been really empowering, actually, to see the girls come out the other end of that.
It sounds like it would have solved the problem that you had right from the start, where you were applying for things and not having these technical, maybe you needed a 14-year-old cyber qualification.
You did need a QA Agile Academy.
Another thing I was thinking about in terms of perspectives, you know, you hear a lot of people talking about video games and puzzles and science kits normally geared towards male audiences. You know, you normally see people tweeting if they're in, I don't know, Tesco or Asda, and it's the kids' tops about, you know, the boys have rockets and the girls have princess. And I'm curious what you guys think about, you know, is it about creating more puzzles and kits and video games that are aimed towards women, or is it about trying to take the male element out and making it almost genderless? What do you think, Lucy?
I personally think making it genderless, because I'd say for me, like, one of the main reasons I didn't like see programming or like tech, obviously I'm a developer, so like the programming side's quite like to me, but like when I was younger, like my brother always got like the games, the like fix it, but I wanted the Lego toys, you know what I mean? I wanted to play with them, I wanted to build it, but I wasn't allowed because that was William's, whereas I got like the nail kit, the hair kit from like, not like from my family, but from the extended family. And situations like that, yeah, I think it shouldn't suddenly just all go girls. I think it needs to be, like, say, genderless. So you need to take away man and, like, woman and let, like, the kids play with whatever they'd like to, basically. That's my opinion on it.
I think it can create a sense of slight resentment from women who also don't associate with being girly, or, yeah. You know, which is definitely was me when I was a kid. I was very sort of resentful of the idea of, you know, I thought it was really annoying when relatives who were in their nicest way possible, distant relatives giving me makeup or moisturiser or whatever in my Christmas stocking, very kind of them. But I was frustrated by it too. And I don't think I necessarily was consciously thinking, oh, you know, girls get this and boys get that. It was more a sort of feeling of being misunderstood. And kind of being like, this isn't me. Why do people assume that I'm going to be like this?
Yeah, I think I struggle with this one because I think genderless would be the ideal. And in an ideal society, we'd do genderless. But I'm not always fully convinced that society is there yet. Mm. So I genuinely am like, look, the more the merrier. If we can have gendered ones for girls, that's great. If we can also have genderless ones, that's amazing. And Let Toys Be Toys is fantastic in what they're doing. And they've been going for so long and supermarkets are still making the same mistakes of, you know, dinosaur versus unicorn. But we see it with the girls coming through. I think it's not their fault that that's the world that they're being conditioned into. Mm. So it probably doesn't hurt to have a Barbie that's a scientist. It probably doesn't hurt to have a girls' puzzle book. As we kind of go through this transition phase where we do need to phase it out and it's not genderless. But there are so many people, so many girls we work with who very strongly identify as that girly girl.
Yeah.
And actually what I love about the way we do things is that, you know, whoever you are, whatever you identify as and the rest of it, this is not about necessarily that. Like, you bring that to what you're building and what you're creating and whoever the role model might be that you're meeting with that day. But, you know, this is about a way of communicating or a way of creating that you can create something for your makeup, as well as you can create something for your dancing, as well as you can create something for your mud or your gaming or whatever it is. Like, the technology doesn't care, ultimately. Mm. I think that's what we just need to ensure that's the message that gets through.
I want to hear a little bit more both from both your perspectives about the system. But before we do that, Lucy, I'd like to hear a bit more about, you know, your story. Like, at what point did you sort of, I guess, shift into tech, or at least what point did you think, oh, actually, you know what, I'm going to do this? And I'm curious, what do you think sort of inspired that?
So the real point for me was when I was like applying after my graduation. I'd already applied to quite a few like finance sites I'd mentioned before, but they didn't really like go through. I then started looking up at like the consulting side, and then I started looking at like what looked interesting, what like areas could I kind of go into. Then I kind of started applying to a few tech roles. But again, that's when I got like, you've got no experience, blah, blah. And then I was quite lucky. I went for an interview up in Manchester with a company. And this is where QA were hosting that interview. They said I didn't get that job, but QA offered me a role with the 3 months training. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to give this a go. Like, it seems really interesting. And I loved the course. Like, we did lots of different things each week, exposing me to loads of different like development, testing, different sides. And that's really like the point for me when I decided, actually, I really, really like this. And then I was just so lucky at the end of the 3 months, got put into a role. Mm. And that's when I went over to Pace. And yeah, I just think all the similarities that you have, like the problem solving, for me, that's the main thing that I have in my like day to day that I love. And I can't believe that I had it all along and I knew that I loved that, but I never knew that could be transitioned, basically.
I guess it just keeps going back to that whole awareness thing, doesn't it? It's almost like, I mean, I think most people who have similar jobs like this, at least nowadays, have similar stories where you don't necessarily wake up when you're a kid and be like, I'm going to be a developer. It's almost someone suggests it to you offhand, or you're in an interview and someone goes, oh, what about this? Or have you thought about that? Or you accidentally end up on a web page. And I'm curious, what do you think now that you're in this role? And I'd also love to hear from you and Marie on this from maybe a more external perspective. one of the things we talk a lot about is how do we get more women into tech? But do we talk enough about how do we retain women in tech, and how do we talk about the culture and systems that you're then up against once you're in the job? So I'd love to hear from your perspective first, Lucy. What do you think, you know, if you love what you do, what's great about it and why are you still there? Or what do you think more in general can be done more to kind of keep women in these roles?
So I think one thing that I really, really enjoy doing that I've been going to quite a few is, you know, like meetup styles for like different people host them and all sorts. But there's one from a lady called Therese who's just started up a new one called Codename Maxine, and she's from Deloitte. So I think it's hosted mainly by Deloitte. But they're just meetups for like girls in tech, but also encourage men to come along. They have presentations and like inspirational stories, that kind of event. I get to talk about my role, and I speak to loads and loads of different people who are older, younger, thinking about transitioning from like a BA, a business analyst, into more of a technical role. And they are struggling because they can't go through the training that I've gone through and stuff. But it's really nice because in this one, there's a big like emphasis on including like males, because obviously like, I don't know, my opinion, if we start all women, then we're going to end up, it seems like you're fighting against each other, whereas you want to be like involved. So going back to that, it was mainly like the meetups, getting to that chance to actually talk and inspire other people and get inspiration from others. That's important.
I want to come back to that male point before we do. Anne-Marie, I'd love to hear a little bit from your perspective. What do you think about, you know, how do companies make it appealing for women not just to, you know, come and work in tech roles, but to stay in them and want to be that leader, as you said earlier on, that they absolutely can be?
So companies need to just do better. I think it's one of those things where, you know, if we look at equal pay, if we look at, you know, the women that are in leadership and how promotion works, if we look at policies around not just maternity leave and that kind of thing, but even expenses. So I'm sure you've both heard of the great book Invisible Women, written by Caroline Criado Perez. But there's an example I always pull out from that where I think in the UK, 90% of single parents are women. In the US, it's 80%. And she gives this example of a senior director who is invited to a director's dinner. And they are a single parent. And so everyone else is not a single parent. And so just checks themselves into the hotel next door to where the dinner is going to be. And that's fine. That's how they're attending. And this single parent has to check with the babysitter and book the babysitter in. And then when I do this with corporates, I always ask them the question, OK, cool, are the hotels expensable at your company? And they're like, yeah, OK. And I'm like, OK, the babysitter, is that expensive? It's like, well, that's what that person needs. To participate in this work thing the same way as everyone else needed a hotel. And so you need to look at your policies to make sure that actually they're much more inclusive and they don't have this assumed norm that people have a housewife at home, which is effectively what it is. So I think there's all kinds of policies that companies need to look at in terms of retention. But, you know, one last example. So I went to speak at a company a couple of years ago and kind of, you know, did this whole thing. Here's what you can do to be better with retention, hiring and promotion. And their CTO came up to me afterwards and said, you know what, Anne-Marie, thanks so much, you know, love all of that. I sponsor our women's network. And it's a he. So he was like, yeah, I sponsor our women's network and da 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 da. But, you know, there's different incidents that happen sometimes and I don't always know what to do. And so he gave the example of a woman that was effectively being bullied in her team and people were making kind of sexist jokes at her expense. And he kind of said, you know, and I had to just remove her from that team and put her to a different department. I said, okay. Right, so when these jokes were happening as part of the work day, where was her manager? Transpires it was her manager that was the person that was making the jokes. And so I said, okay, cool, so you need to look at your managers. Are you able to manage someone effectively if you're doing that? Secondly, why was she the person you moved rather than the perpetrator? And there's all these other things where I think you just have to think about that there are little things, you know, they might seem too small or inconsequential, but they're the things that then add up to effectively what comes out in an exit interview where you end up having a dossier of all the reasons why you left. And it's not one reason. It's about 1,000 reasons that have happened over about 1,000 days. So companies need to look at the small and start with exit interviews.
I really like that that's kind of very applied answer to my question, because I think sometimes when we sort of ask the question of what can be done, it can sometimes feel very overwhelming because, you know, we can, as women, we can all list all these microaggressions very quickly and they come to mind. But sometimes it's quite hard to be like, how do you actually solve that from a cultural perspective? But the reality is there are some real, like very physical reality based things like policies, for instance, like exit interviews that can be done. I want to ask another, shall we, not controversial question, but another question with the two sides to it. I'm curious, and maybe this is a bit of a meta question considering we're on a podcast talking about women in tech, is talking about women in tech hindering the process of making things better in any way? And the way I sort of see it, and a question I got asked once when I was doing a talk about my career, a young woman in the audience who was in the middle of their university career, and she asked me the question, said, I know it's going to be really hard for me because I'm female when I get into the workforce, so what should I do now to prepare? And I was really saddened by that question. I was really like, God, I don't want you to feel fearful before you're even there. I don't want you to be like getting your armor up and, you know, kind of want you to just go in and you know. So I'm curious about, are we creating fear at all by kind of, for the younger generations, by essentially sort of telling them that there's trouble ahead? What do you think, Anne-Marie?
Would you rather get to 10 years in and be like, this is too much and no one ever told me and all these people lied to me and I'm going to leave and go and open a farm in the middle of the countryside and not contribute to tech?
But then the fear for me is that you wouldn't even try in the first place. It would put you off even trying.
So no, I'm not. I don't know that it would. I think if you, it's how you do it. You know, you can never control how someone receives a message, but we have this with the Stimets. You know, lots of them now are working in industry. And they still come and talk to us and they tell us all the terrible things that are happening, whether it's harassment, whether it, you know, there's all kinds of things that they're seeing. And I think, and it's something one of our advisors said to us really early on, and they said, you know, you need to be honest with the girls, actually, because otherwise there's no point doing all the work that you're doing. And I think because they go into it, what we found is actually they're going into the industry knowing that stuff is going to happen and being like, I'm not going to take it. As a number of girls we know who have gone, they've done really well, they've kind of gone into industry and they'll call us up and they'll be like, yeah, Anne-Marie, I've quit my job because they did that and that's just not good enough. And so I'm going to go start my own thing. And I'm like, okay, I mean, you're empowered. You understand that you love tech. You didn't necessarily love that workplace, which I think is kind of what might have been missing. But I think we have a responsibility to be open about the issues and to talk about it. And I think it's progress. So there's, you know, across STEM, there's lots of different industries, I guess. And I can say with technology, even if some of it's lip service, at least being able to say it out loud has meant that we've moved much quicker than other industries. Not going to name names, rhymes with Bengineering, where, you know, they almost are like, no, there's no women problem. Women don't want to do it. And really senior people across the industry believe this and they're not talking about it as a problem. And I know women that are afraid that in the industry, there's huge repercussions for them. And so actually, I feel like I have to do that because I'm not going to lose charter status, for example, from an engineering institution. If I say this is rubbish, you don't pay people, there's harassment everywhere, you don't promote them, and actually there's lots of bullying that's going on. You know, these women are great. We need them to engineer because women also live in the world that you're building these bridges and building these shoes and these products for. But I think we do have to talk about it. And it's similar to the racism thing of, you know, if you're tired of hearing about racism, try being tired of living with it. Crimea River kind of thing. So I think we have to talk about it. We have to talk about it until it's not a problem anymore. And running away from it and not talking about it is not going to get us there any quicker.
I think we've had so many conversations over the years, and kind of leading on to my next question, we've been talking about women in tech for such a long time. Have things changed? I mean, things have changed, but they also haven't. I'm curious, what do you guys think still needs to be done?
I don't know what needs to be done, but I can give you an example of something to me that's like essentially like a blocking on the opposite side of it. So like when I came out of my like training, and you're going into jobs these days, it's like, so there'll be like a pool of people and we all need to like apply for different things. It's like, well, you're a girl, you'll get it because you need to fill that quota, you're a number, you're a girl. And that then, for me personally, that's like, actually, no, I'm going to go out there and show you that I am for the job. And that pushes me that way. But also it upsets me that I get that. I shouldn't need to have to deal with people saying, well, you're not actually cut out for the role, but you are a woman, so like, you'll be all right. There's that side of it, which I think, to me, that's awful.
Yeah, I've experienced that myself actually quite a few times. And I'd love to hear from you, Anne-Marie, as well. What do you think still needs to be done, and have things changed?
So things have changed. The stats have moved in the last couple of years on digital, on tech, on STEM as a kind of wider field. So things are improving in that way, but obviously that doesn't mean that they're all completely done and perfect. So I think what we need to do is see more of that kind of equal pay, more of those policies, and trying to embed improvements rather than having them as just kind of cultural ones and relying on people to have heard the message or to have read the particular book. So I think that policy thing that I mentioned earlier is what we need to look to. But those changes being earnestly done kind of across the board. So I think doing it early is really important, But if you hire 50-50 male-female, for example, in your first couple of years and then a couple of years up, that seems to disappear. I can't celebrate with you that you've got 50-50 lower down and 0-100 at the top.
Yeah.
You know, A for effort at the beginning, F fail at the end. Yeah, so it needs to be embedded, basically.
If we could play the tape forward 10 years, what are our hopes and aspirations for women in technology moving forward? Going to start with you, Emery.
That we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Love it. You're putting out of a job.
It'd be like, there was a time, 2020. yeah, I'd be redundant.
Yeah.
That's, I say all the time, I don't want to be running Stimets still. Don't want to have to do these things. We need to be, the standards need to be embedded across culture and it just needs to be better. So 10 years, you know, optimistic that it can change in that time. But who knows, crazier things have happened.
And you can retire to the beach. Love it.
Or to go do something else, like yeah. some more techie things.
Love it.
That's what I started off doing. I miss it.
Anne-Marie, you mentioned that, you know, in an idealised world, you wouldn't have to exist doing your job in STEMETS. What would you do if you weren't doing what you were doing now?
Many things. I don't know. I'd probably be running like a cyber school. Yeah, so something along those lines. Or I'd be a TV commissioner.
Wait, is that a TV commissioner? Okay, is that a school that is online or is that a school about like cybersecurity?
It's too many details that you're asking. it'd be a school about cyber.
Okay.
So the idea is at the moment, there are lots of people in like villages in different places who are like the social media person for the town or the village.
Oh.
So they like go to the hairdressers and they run the Facebook page for the hairdresser. I know this because I did this when I was younger.
Oh.
And you kind of go around and you're like, you need to be on social media. If you pay me like however much a month, I'll run your social media. So we have that. I mean, you obviously have bigger social agencies for big companies. But with cyber, lots of companies that do cyber things only do it on like £1 million contracts. And if you're the local hairdresser, you also still need that service for cyber. So we'd probably end up doing that and filling that like gap in the market and empowering people to do cyber at like the small level. So I'd either do that or be a TV commissioner or both because, you know.
Why not?
Yeah.
Multi-hyphenate and all that jazz. Mm-hmm. Any investors listening, you can get involved with the Imafidin Cyber School 2021. Lizzie, would you be doing anything different if you weren't doing what you do? Or actually, maybe I can formulate a different way. What will you do next?
What will I do next? I'd really like I said, to move up in the roles, and I'd like to like manage people within my company and also like mentor. And I really want to work with projects that actually like influence like society in a better way. Basically, that's what I'd really like to do in the future.
It's funny, we talk a lot about being in tech, but tech is just, you know, it's kind of everything, isn't it? So really, when we talk about what it is that you want to do, it's not wanting to work in tech, it's wanting to, you know, as you say, either affect the world or commission TV or whatever. I mean, most of these roles are tech inherent anyway, aren't they?
Yes, 21st century living.
Last question for you guys, because I'd love to be able to give the listeners a little bit of an actionable action that they can take. Tell me someone, a woman in STEM, that they should go Google, they should go find out more about, follow on Twitter or all the other places on social media. Who should they? Or someone historical that you think they should learn a little bit herstory about, as you say, Anne-Marie.
So they can't follow her on Twitter because she's not on Twitter. So they should follow me instead or follow the Stimets account.
That feels like a very self-serving answer, Anne-Marie. but carry on. You guys should follow
I haven't
Anne-Marie.
Had the Twitter growth that I expected this month. joking, sorry. You should follow the Stimets account. And it sounds self-serving, but actually we profile women constantly, continuously. If it's someone's birthday, if it's the anniversary of them discovering something, if Jess Wade has uploaded a Wikipedia article on them, you can follow Jess Wade as well, but follow Stimets too. And we have lots of profiles continuously. But the person you should Google is Gladys West, because she's not dead yet. And I think we need to give her something before she goes.
Love it. Go to you, Lucy.
Yeah, for me, I think is like the awareness from reading about it. So picked up a few books, like started reading like Careers Advice for Ambitious Women, just small things like that that have like triggered and sparked more things. I'm definitely going to take it in action from this on my own self to look up some women.
Love it. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me on Get 2020 Vision. I'm going to pop some of the links in the podcast bio of some of these amazing role models and STEM women and resources that's been mentioned throughout the podcast. I think what was interesting from this conversation was that there was a lot of nuance in what we discussed. You know, things have changed, but there's still lots to do. Some things are really actionable, but on the other side, some things are very cultural. There's kind of two ways of looking at this, or actually multiple ways of looking at this. You know, women are all individuals. It's not one kind of quick fix that we can do to make a situation better. But some of the kind of key points that I thought were interesting, this idea of awareness and confidence. How can we actually just tell women, young women, what opportunities are even out there so they can almost do the work themselves if they just know that it exists. There are real policies that companies can do, real experience that we can offer and provide for those that might not necessarily already be getting it. One of the really interesting things I thought that Anne-Marie mentioned was this idea of listening to exit interviews. Sometimes there's some really small things that we can all do to make things better, both men and women. And I'm really excited, actually, about what the future might hold. There seems like it's not too big of a problem that cannot be attacked in any way whatsoever. And in some ways, I feel quite optimistic after that discussion. Thank you all for listening to this episode. And remember, you can go back and listen to our previous episodes when you subscribe to the show on any of your podcast player apps. So make sure you check them out if you've not already. I'd love to hear from you all, especially if you have any questions you want answered or topics you want covered in future episodes. So if you want to get in touch, please send your message or questions to get2020vision@qa.com, or you can search the hashtag get2020vision on social media. Until next time, I've been Gemma Milne. This has been Get 2020 Vision, brought to you by QA. To find out more about the work QA does, visit qa.com.